Welcome to Mind Crime Liberty Show with me, Swithin Dobson, and him, Tim Patton. Today we discuss whether Aristotle was right about slavery. As you may know, or as you may not, Aristotle claimed that there were natural slaves. Well, whether he thought they actually existed or not was another matter. Although I do think from his writings, he does think they do exist. But that's basically irrelevant for the purpose of this directly. So in book one of The Politics, Aristotle says this: those who are as different from other men as the soul from the body, or man from the beast, and they are in this state if their work is the use of the body, and if this is the best that can come from them, are slaves by nature. For them it is better to be ruled in accordance with this sort of rule, if such is the case for the other things mentioned. So his claim is, you know, if these people have effectively no real use of reason, that they are effectively similar to, they're more similar to animals than they are to the gods. And so, as it is fitting for animals, as it were, to be domesticated, in an analogous sense, it is for the slave. The slave has a servile nature, he has poor use of reason, and it is better for him to be ruled, and it is better for the more rational man to rule over him, because it's better for the ruler and it is better for the slave. So the question then arises, who would be a good candidate for the natural slave? Well, in the Aristotelian sense of natural, you could argue he's being somewhat inconsistent, or at least he's using natural in a different sense. Because natural in the Aristotelian sense points to sort of like its inbuilt directedness, what it is by nature, what it is in its mature and sort of good form, what it tends towards. And since he defines men as rational animals, this wouldn't really sit very well with his sort of conception of slavery, or of the natural slave, sorry. So in a very strict sense, I don't think the natural slave makes any sense under the Aristotelian framework. So if we're going to be charitable and treat him as being consistent, I think his term natural here is a modified one. Maybe the particular individual has a particular disposition which would lead him towards being a natural slave. So given that being the case, I mean, who would be the obvious candidate for that? Well, in a sense, you could say children, but children aren't really a good example because they are immature. And so they will develop to the point of reason and therefore would no longer, in a sense, be a candidate for a natural slave. The ones of sort of the mentally retarded or those of general low IQ in the sort of adult form, they would more fit a more strict sense of the natural slave, because their reasoning ability is so poor. I mean even today, I mean, that they're not considered as having been able to give consent or to basically form contracts. So effectively they're under you could say the guardianship of somebody else. Although that then brings us to the question in the sense of what is a slave. The sort of, might say, the ideal type of the slave is, I think you had this in the Roman Empire, maybe under the Republic or in the time of the kings, a slave owner could buy and sell his slave, but also could even execute him if he saw fit. I think even the father could execute his own son at certain points in Roman history. That seems to be the ideal type, but slavery has been multifarious in its forms. I believe I read about Athenian slavery, which would be more relevant for Aristotle. A slave master couldn't unduly beat a slave. If he did, then he could be taken to court. I mean, there were sort of restrictions on what he could or could not do with a slave. So, although, of course, you could buy and sell them. So I suppose there's a question of, you know, what, in a sense, constitutes genuine slavery. But for those who find poor use of reason, as it were, the very sort of low IQ and the mentally retarded would seem to be the most clear examples of them. Tim, what's your thoughts on this issue?
Well, I think my first comment is, are you describing the contents of an empty box or an oxymoron? Now, again, I'm trying to be charitable here, but the idea that there exists a natural slave seems to fit this category. I'll leave the comments about children aside momentarily, but the you know, the low IQ or the disabled person, there's no real net in benefit per se in some sort of employment profit-based relationship to have them. You know, a lot of stores and businesses will hire you know, people to do certain tasks. You know, a lot of family businesses will have, you know, have the, but these aren't the people who drive the production function of the business. And even in a socialist society, in a utopian socialist society, you wouldn't put the handicapped person to pilot the airline or you know, the space colonizing program. I mean, that would be absurd. So it's quite obvious that the people who would be good at doing this, the people who have value, would not really be necessarily so there wouldn't be much of a profit incentive in that regard, and there wouldn't be much of a labor theory incentive either in that regard as well. I mean, you're not going to call them if the server breaks or the basement gets flooded and so forth. So I will say that first. I will say that first as far as the candidates. And I do think that in general, there is an economic benefit, not economic benefit, but an economic motive to acquire slaves. It's quite clear. The American Southern South slavery was built mainly for profit of the masters necessarily. That was the main driver of it. And same way with the feudal system and the serfdom systems that existed in Europe for a long time. They existed for the masters to make money and get above subsistence and so forth. So, you know, when the Romans would go out and conquer Carthage, they enslaved something like X thousand numbers of the people. Same way with when the Romans went to Israel and so forth. You know, they're useful to build projects and so forth. So so the slaves that are valuable are the ones that can do valuable tasks. And not to sound overtly ableist in the sense, but, you know, this leaves out a huge number of this whittles the candidates down to a very small number. And then again, are we talking about an empty box here? Swithin, any further comments?
The point about economic benefit is interesting. I do think the ones I've described so far probably wouldn't be a good candidate, or at least for an economically profitable natural slave. But if you were to take a softer position on who could consider the natural slave, I do think there's quite a lot of people who you could make the claim that would be economically valuable, and actually their life would be better if they were a slave than if they were free. So, for example, I'm thinking primarily people who tend to have quite high time preference and aren't very forward thinking. And to be fair, there's quite a lot of those people. So, for example, there was a representative from an organization called the very banally called Christians Against Poverty, which always makes me think, well, where's the Christians for Poverty group? It's like, it just seems odd. Anyway, he was saying how he deals with sort of household budgeting for people getting into debt. And there was a guy he was with, and he was like, talking about budgeting. He was like, I've got to spend 50 quid a week on booze, no questions asked. It's like, that's what he had to spend £50 on. And I'm thinking, you're in debt and you're spending £50 a week on alcohol, which is like, what, $70-$75 a week, who has relatively low income, that probably isn't a good use of your money. Now, I don't know anything about this guy, but for some particularly sort of manual work, you know, he could be quite useful. And frankly, you know, he might be able to do relatively skilled blue collar work. And, you know, if he was owned by a slave master, you know, he could generate some economic profit from the ownership of him. But this guy, in a softer sense, you could say is a candidate for the natural slave, because he basically has very poor use of reason. At least in a sense, you could treat him in that way. And so the question would be, you know, this is an economically beneficial relationship for the master, but you could also make the claim that being a slave is actually a good thing for the slave, because this guy is like, well, the slave master's like, well, you're not having £50 a week of alcohol. Like, that's just ridiculous. I can give you some, give you a ration of it, but, you know, that's not good for you. It's not good for me. I will give you other things which are going to be better for you. If it's better for him and he's in better sort of health and condition, he's going to be more profitable as a slave. But also your life, you know, your health and your general well-being will be better. That would be a... that, I think, you know, you could say is not necessarily just an empty box. That's a situation of economic benefits, but also a situation in which the you could make the claim that the slave, because of his poor use of reason, is a natural one in a soft sense, and therefore is better off being a slave than he is being a free man. Because you mean you could claim, you know, you could just be a servant of this master and he could leave. So he's not sort of slavery, he's not having to be kept there against his will as such. But it would be better for him to have the money spent for him, because you just waste the money if he was given it. Tim?
I think a definition of what a slave here would be pertinent to make. Is the serfs of, say, you know, Russia circa 1800 to 1860 considered slaves in some narrow sense, or in some broad sense considered slaves? I also think it's worthwhile bringing up Marx, because in the Hans Hoppe's lecture on what Marx gets right, one of the points that Marx makes, or it might be in his lecture on clean capitalism, is one of the points that Marx would argue that even in an NAP-compatible world, well, Hans Hoppe argues that even in a perfectly homesteaded world, there's still exploitation. And exploitation in the sense that the master profits from the slave surplus value. Now, forgetting how do you calculate this and all these other questions that go into this dilemma, you know, Hans Hoppe just assumes that, you know, even under clean capitalism, and Marx would just argue that wage slavery is slavery. So in that sense, you know, people who work for corporations who don't get every last dollar are considered slaves in the Marxist sense, because, you know, there's nothing new. It's still you know, capitalism is slavery in this regard. So I think a definition check to here to a certain extent is relevant. Now, I'm not saying Aristotle had this definition 2000 years ago, but Walter Buck had a definition where, well, you couldn't run away. You couldn't choose a different master, and you couldn't start your own firm. Those are some of Walter Block's qualifications of what makes a slave. Now, the libertarian question of, like, is taxation slavery or kidnapping? Well, this is complicated, because I don't think it's slavery in the formal sense, but the Marxists are going to argue that wage slavery is slavery. And I think, yes, taxation is slavery in the same sense. You don't get to choose. I mean, you could always run away. Although in some states, it's hard to run away. And this is where Hans Hoppe would argue East Germany is sort of a slave society. And I think it's a fair point to make that, you know, they couldn't run away fairly well, especially in like East Berlin, where they had a great place right next to them. I think North Korea is also a slave society in some sense. If you look at the Vice videos of some of the workers in Russia, they're sentenced to like 10-year terms. And then they log for Russia, and they probably do very valuable work. But then they send the money back to Kim Jong-un so he can build a ski resort or build nuclear weapons. So in that sense, I mean, would these people be classified as slaves? So what we have here is a continuing problem. Now, serfdom in Russia, from Richard Pipe's book, you know, the serfs had rights. You couldn't break up their families, from my understanding. You couldn't kill them. But, you know, when the landlord showed up, he had certain privileges that existed. And unless you started a rebellion, you know, everyone basically accepted them. So Swithin, any comments on Walter Block's or the sort of definition problem? I mean, the classic definition is always, you know, the American South slave. That's because this, you know, the SJW left loves, you know, going on and on about this, or maybe some sort of, you know, the Belgians and in, or the Germans in Africa. Those are the classic definitions people use of slavery. That's the sort of ooh yuck. But broadly speaking, if you want to sit back and make a sort of general historical universal definition, what would be the qualifications for a slave?
That's a good question. I think Blocks is broadly fine. That you can't choose who your master is. You can't leave. That seems to be the essence, as it were, of slavery, as if you were trying to abstract it from various different forms. And I think with that, so I suppose here the only genuine form of slavery, in a sense, you could say, is chattel slavery. I mean, if you can't be sold, that seems to be. Then you're not really a slave. You might be an indentured servant. I mean, it all depends how you want to rack it up. But I think that would certainly be consistent with Aristotle. I mean, it's certainly consistent with, say, Athenian democracy. It's like, no, I meant Athenian slavery. But yeah, I mean, you can't choose your master. They tell you what to do, and you can't run away. I mean, that seems to be perfectly. I think that's a perfectly reasonable definition. I don't know of many that I can't really think of a situation. I think, yeah, that would be slavery. That's what I would understand as slavery. That wouldn't hold to. And given the way I'm looking at this now, actually, the case of being told what to do and you can't leave and you can't choose your master is basically exactly what I'm going at here. It's so that it's your own, such that you're told what to do and you can't leave. I mean, that's basically the essence of what you're going with. And obviously, the extent of what you're told to do, etc., and what the master is allowed to do to the slave is going to be of varying degrees of severity. It might be the case that some physical chastisement is fine, and other cases it might not be. It means you could do absolutely loads. I mean, in the Old Testament, I'm pretty sure if you severely beat the slave, he was allowed to leave, for example. So you could have things like that. So you could have sort of like the benign slaveholder who, you know, treats his slaves well. He feeds them. He tells them what to do in their job and whatever, and they can't go. But, you know, he houses them well. He doesn't mistreat them. Beyond, I suppose, you could argue mistreatment and not being allowed to do what they want to do. I mean, I think that's perfectly consistent with it. And actually, probably is one of the more interesting ones to discuss is, you know, what would be wrong with that situation? I mean, it's obvious, in a sense, in today's world, the intuition is, yeah, well, it's obvious that severely beating the slave is bad. That's kind of a boring discussion. It's like, well, yeah, of course it's bad. But, you know, if you had sort of like the benign slaveholder, I mean, would it actually be good for that guy who spent all his money on alcohol, you know, being spent money for him, as it were? In a certain sense, you know, you could see at least the benefits, even though you may not want to justify it, that would actually be a beneficial situation. Tim?
I would like to make a comment on voluntary slavery, because I think this goes back to the sort of oxymoron part of this. Walter Block sometimes gets parodied for saying is, you know, you could sell yourself into slavery in Kapistan. Whether or not Walter Block actually believes this, whether or not this would happen, is all of some question. But nonetheless, you know, you could sell the idea of if you idea entering a relationship or you're selling yourself into it, in some sense it's easiest to be slavery because you chose it. You chose it. And if you choose it, then it's in a way voluntary, and then in a way you bought your tickets, you know what you're getting into, and you got into it. So I mean, if you take the feminist standard, feminists would argue that marriage is kind of an enslaving thing. And actually, there's a quote that comes from, I think it's Gloria Steinem said it, and that's actually that Harriet Tubman, from my recent look into this. You know, this is the quote that Kanye West got in trouble for retweeting, that, you know, that she freed thousands, but she could have freed millions if they knew they were slaves. Because, of course, after the Civil War, plenty of the slaves stayed. Plenty of the masters didn't even tell their slaves that they were freed. And since the South is so big and so large, the Union Army couldn't get everywhere. And not that the Union Army really cared, but don't tell that to Harry Jaffa. Nonetheless, you know, plenty of the slaves stayed. So to a certain extent, it's voluntary. And the same way with marriage, you know, even though the many feminists will say this, and this is where the quote comes from, probably that got misattributed to her. You know, if you take the sort of idea of the, you know, the boogeyman patriarchal marriage, which doesn't really exist in modern society since the courts don't do it. I mean, you can, as Peter Hitchens said, you can get out of it easier than a car loan. So in that sense, it's not really that. So in this sense, it's voluntary. Now, one of the questions the Marxists, of course, are, well, you don't have very good options. But then this to me becomes, well, I mean, a caveman 10,000 years ago, you know, doesn't have very good options if he breaks his leg or there's a flood. I mean, there's certain scarcities just built into the system. You get stuck in the desert, you might die of thirst. You know, this is not a social construction. There's just certain scarcities built in. So now maybe you say, well, those social circumstances that lead to people signing up to these contracts are problematic. But then again, you know, existence to a certain extent has lots of, you know, not nice things and so forth. So I don't think the argument that people don't have good choices, therefore they sign up to these bad contracts, which would be voluntary slavery, is a very good argument out of it. Because, you know, I mean, in some ways, this is the argument that the Marxists make about people who get signed up to wage slavery. Of course, they can't. Rebelling is not an option. They're not going to get. So they just accept it. But then this goes to me back into the idea of a natural slave. And this actually is a funny of a sort of a Nietzschean aside as well, where, well, the people who rebel, they're the ones who are the true masters. They're the natural aristocracy. The people who don't choose to rebel, they're the ones who are natural slaves. I mean, if you look at someone like, you can see these in any society. You know, if you look, I mean, you pull up Elon Musk, Genghis Khan, Putin, Ayn Rand, even, you know, the first generation monarchs who go out and, or some of the Roman patricians, you know, these are not, and actually even many of the early feminists, these are not effeminate people. They're very, you know, master oriented. Now, whether or not they're very good Christians is of some question. Not the Romans were Christians, but this to me, the people who would select these things, these take these bad contracts, they are the ones that choose to do it. And if they choose to do it, again, this becomes the old Brian Kaplan dilemma she had with his debate with Elizabeth Bruneg. Is if people choose to go to McDonald's and spend all their money, or if people choose to go to the bar and spend all their money, or people choose to go to the casino and spend all their money, I mean, that's what they chose to do. You know, I don't see any way out of it that plenty of people will choose to do this quote unquote ruinous pass, which does not put them in a good place into bargain. And actually, as Hans Hoppe points out, it's only because we live in a wealthy society that we can even have these things that have this large welfare state. If we weren't living in a wealthy society, and Rand would point this out too, you know, even the Amish up until recently, and there's a book about this, where the Amish would just say, if you didn't on some level, the Amish would, you know, they would kick the people out who didn't want to work. And if they have an actual disability, they would keep them, but they would shun them. So the amount of charity we have is dependent on the wealth we have. So this is back to the Walter Bakhtin point, is that, you know, wealthier is better. So, you know, I do think that natural slaves might exist, but they exist on some sort of conscious level where people choose to make a bad deal or choose to put themselves in a bad situation. Why they would do that, I don't know. I'm not entirely sure. But Swithin, any comments?
Yeah, I would agree with the I mean, that's kind of the people I'm paying. People kind of with the bad situation, as it were, are the natural slave. But I do think that they can be productive as well. I mean, I do think it is sort of economically beneficial. It could be economically beneficial for the slave owner to own them, because they might be good at one thing but terrible at something else. You know, you'd be quite good at your job but then waste all your money. I mean, that's perfectly possible. And so this is sort of, I suppose this is proactive welfare, in that actually the problem, you could say the problem with the welfare state, it allows people to make bad choices, and then you subsidize them indirectly for them. Whereas in a good sort of benign slavery society, you stop them making the bad decisions to begin with. And that's why they need to be slaves under the sort of benign slaveholder situation. An interesting thing I remember on slavery, Hopper makes a distinction between the private and the public slave. He makes the claim that in communism, basically everyone's a slave. But if you had to choose between to be living in a communist society or to be owned by a private slaveholder, you would rather be owned by a private slaveholder, because the private slaveholder has an interest in maintaining the market value of you as a slave. Because if he let you get really useless and fat and lazy, then you won't be able to sell him for very much. But you can't do that in communism because you're not allowed to sell them. And so consequently, in a sense, there is an interest on part of a slaveholder to actually keep the slaves actually in relatively good condition. Now, obviously, how good a condition is going to be dependent upon the supply of slaves. You know, if you've got a relatively short supply of slaves, then their conditions are probably going to be relatively better. But obviously, if a lot of them, they won't be. With respect to the feminist claim that marriage is slavery, I suppose Rothbard makes a similar argument, because this is where Rothbard and Bloch diverge significantly with the whole is the will alienable and is it not? Because the whole point of the way Rothbard creates his sort of title transfer theory of contract is to basically, he starts basically with the assumption that contracts are basically unenforceable because it binds the will. Now, he gets around this with the performance bond, which I won't go into. But so it's in the Rothbardian position, the idea, if you're in a marriage, you can dissolve it at will, because if you don't, if you can't do that, you're a slave, because your future free choices are legally constrained. So actually Bloch's position on voluntary slavery is actually an interesting one, and a much more stark one in the debate, you know, to what extent are your promises, as it were, enforceable. In the current legal framework, some are and some aren't. Rothbard basically wanted to take the position that none of them were, and Bloch says that in a sense, although he does hold the title transfer theory to a large extent, that all of them are. Although I suppose he would say that if both parties of the marriage agreed to dissolve it, they would be able to dissolve it. But I'm pretty sure he would hold the position if one of them decided they wanted to leave, but the other one said, well, I don't want you to, and you signed a contract that you weren't, then that wouldn't be enforced. That would, in a sense, be an enforceable contract. Although I've never seen Bloch write in too much detail about that. But just back to the natural slave directly. So given the discussion so far, would you say that the people who are reasonably economically productive but very bad with spending their money and their use of their time in their leisure time, as it were, would be the sort of more reasonably formerly empty natural slave? Would that be, you think that'd be a fair group of people that might be considered a natural slave?
I'm going to give the yes and no answer, which is in some ways is an open dodge to the question, but in some ways is I think it's a tricky issue. And this goes back to teleology or purpose. One of the things that oftentimes get thrown at libertarians is, you know, if a kid runs across the street, and even Noam Chomsky could say, you can restrain the kid. And there's a part of me that wants to play devil's advocate when this occurs and quote Albert Camus or somebody like that and think that, you know, maybe the kid has some idea running in front of a truck. Now, that sounds horrifying. People will clutch their pearls to say that. But then again, if you watch many movies, you know, euthanasia and suicide, and as well as abortion, of course, is perfectly reasonable to most people. So, you know, maybe the kid is pursuing his natural instinct by running in front of the truck there. And maybe the parent restraining him is the problem. Or does there exist people that just meet the qualifications that probably would benefit? Yes, I'm almost certain there does. I'm almost certain there was. Now, do they actually want to benefit from this? I don't know. This is where it becomes a sort of teleology or purpose-oriented problem, where, you know, if you have to force people to work who, in the short term and the medium term, don't seem to want to work yet or could work, this there's a number of people out there. This becomes this class of people that you're identifying. This is quite tricky. And yes, socialists the socialists will force you to work. This is something that I like that I like to beat in the head every time I get in a debate with a social democrat or any socialist. Is the socialist society, and this is why I like Thad Russell. Socialists are very puritanical in this sense. They will force you to work. The Soviet Union forced you to work. I would argue the people who had to join the Russian Navy to go on those nuclear submarines that were death traps didn't have very good options, in the same way that many Marxists will complain that coal miners in West Virginia or Nevada don't have very good options because, you know, they have to just take what the boss says. Well, that's exactly the same argument in there. Are there a class of people that would benefit? Oh yeah, I don't deny. But is there enough class of paternalistic people who are oriented toward not exploiting them in any perverse sense? That becomes much more of a tricky problem, I would say. This is one of the David Friedman's questions. You know, there's not a good supply of benevolent dictators around. If anyone could find them, that would be great. Then we could just put them in charge. I mean, this is the Platonic King problem. If we could just find them, it would solve all the problems. They could mediate all the disputes, and they could have run the thing perfectly. But they don't exist, and I've yet to see them existing. I mean, you know, they're always sometimes the Marxists will infer there'd be a vanguard class that just emerges, but I've yet to see them emerge. Actually, one instance where I think there is a thing that actually functions in the current society, at least in Western societies, I imagine it does in Britain, but it does in the United States, is the army or the military generally. Plenty of people benefit from the discipline the military has. And actually, the Romans had a similar thing where they would give the option to become soldiers. And actually, those are the people that eventually overran the empire to a certain extent, some extent. They filled their army with the captured people. And after a generation or two, they were just almost no different than the actual Italian soldiers, not Italian, but the Roman soldiers. Plenty of people who, you know, didn't do the best growing up would go join the army. I mean, that's to a certain extent like a slave contract when you join the army, at least in the United States. I imagine it's the exact same in Britain, because to a certain extent the militaries historically have similar overlap as well, or join the Navy. They're forced to do certain things. They're told where to go. I mean, I'd argue joining the military is a form of slavery as well. And actually, in this regard, if they tell you to do a frontal assault wherever, you know, World War One, you know, Grant's Cold Harbor expedition, wherever you are. Yeah, I would say the military is that organization here, in an actual existing organization. Maybe even the public schools to a certain extent, depending on how well you want to enforce the discipline. I mean, they don't do as much as they used to, but most schools in the United States up until a while ago, now it was somewhat decentralized, had corporal punishment, and you know, you could call truancy officers on people. So in that regard, you know, to a certain extent, people are forced to go to school by the force of the gun. And again, Thaddeus Russell identifies this as a kind of slavery as well. So, Swithin, any comments on what I just said about the military or you know, the fact that there's not a good supply of benevolent dictators?
Yeah, I think the military is very similar in a sense to a slave contract, although you can leave, although when you can leave isn't immediately obvious. I don't actually remember. I mean, I'm pretty sure if you're on tour, you can't just go, I want to leave. Like, if you're sent to Helmand province in Iraq, or is that in Afghanistan? I can never remember which. I'm pretty sure you can't decide, oh, I don't really like it here, and I'm going to go home. So in that sense, yes, that would be an interesting example, which you could say is most similar. And actually does show, you know, the benefits. Although I suppose one of the problems with military life is because it's so different from civilian life, is that they can't really function very well in civilian life. Although actually, that said, a lot of people do come out of military and do very well. I mean, a lot of the ones who run sort of private security firms generally have been in the army, at least the ones I've listened to do podcasts and things. I think the point about benevolent dictators is pretty much the big problem. Although that said, even if you did have a benevolent dictator, I think you have a knowledge problem. I think we can all say, yeah, we know who the naturals, we can recognize natural slave when we see them. But being able to identify who they are centrally and decide whether or not they are, in fact, an actual slave is going to be very problematic. Because to be able to determine whether an action shows that they are somehow an actual slave in isolation isn't straightforward. So, for example, I could go to the casino and spend, I don't know, £1,000. And they could, oh, that's, and I'll lose it all. That could be evidence of natural slave behavior. But I might have lots of money and I might not spend much money on anything else, but I just like going to the casino. I do it rather than going on holiday. You would need to know everything about the context of your decision, of your life, to kind of work out whether you were in fact a natural slave or not. Because again, it's not immediately obvious by taking one action in isolation. So you're going to have the problem of to actually identify the natural slave, you might require, assuming you're going to have a relatively high bar of proof to work, oh yeah, he's a natural slave, yeah, we can enslave him. That's going to require a lot of information. And I suppose you could only do that on a relatively local level to have that relevant information. To be able to do that. And that's assuming you're even a benevolent dictator, let alone if you're not. So that's certainly a problem. And even though, in a sense, it's better for people to be told what to do by others, it does seem to be the case that there is some sort of virtue in being able to be responsible for your own decision-making. If you take Aristotle's view that man is a rational animal, it would seem that the archetypal good, flourishing life is the man who he picks the golden mean in all situations and can, you know, by judgment decide what is a good action, what is a bad action for him. And that decision-making process seems to be a desirable characteristic, and it would seem to be you would want to try to cultivate that as much as you possibly could, and so having slaves as such would seem to run against that grain, although you could say it gets to a point at which actually I suppose what you could claim is you can allow that decision making even within the framework of being a slave, and actually that might be economically beneficial, because if you had because actually that's similar in certain respects, sort of delegation in wage contracts in firms. You delegate to your staff and within a certain range of activities them to decide what's best for them to do. although you do that not necessarily just because it's better for them and cultivate the virtue of prudence or phronesis, but it's good economically because they're better placed to make those decisions. So you could say that you could develop that anyway, even within a slave situation. But yeah, the big problem is there aren't very benign dictators, and determining who would be the natural slave is going to be a problem, and you could get a very oppressive situation in which the non-natural slaves end up being slaves, which wouldn't be a good situation for Aristotle, because, you know, the men who should rule, and if you should rule your own life in a sense, then you should do that and not be enslaved by somebody else. So I kind of think, on a practical purpose, at least, slavery, as we've defined it in the Blockian sense, is probably not a good idea. Now, that said, whilst we recognize it might yield some good outcomes, is there a way of doing this which is less severe than slavery? And this moves on to the idea of paternalistic policies. I saw an article which I didn't read that Boris Johnson was apparently looking into banning adverts for quote-unquote junk food to tackle obesity. Does the sort of the natural slave, as it were, do they justify these sort of more minor paternalistic policies? Because they wouldn't necessarily require the same machinery to enforce. And would sort of, on a cost-benefit analysis, would that be preferable? Another example that you could use apart from obesity might be sort of alcohol and cigarette consumption. You kind of have that to gay with the drug laws anyway. And possibly, I think, one of the more defensible ones, although I think there are issues with it, which I'll get to later, people make the argument for like the forced saving schemes as being good. The argument that people don't save enough for their retirement. And so you have a situation where if you'd left them to their own devices, they would have no money to spend when they're economically unproductive, say in their 70s. And so they'd be destitute in their old age. And therefore, it's good to force people to save when they're younger so that they can support themselves in retirement. That might be the more defensible one. So, Tim, what do you think on the more broad paternalistic policies? Do you think they don't suffer from the same problems as a slave society would have in the sort of that we described? Or do you think they have similar problems, although they're not as severe?
Well, the first comment I'll make is that, of course, the Marxists, as Hans Hoppe pointed out, would consider the current society a slave society, although a less minor one. But nonetheless, they would say that most people are slaves because they can't choose their masters, and they have to make choice between bad and worse options. So that's the first comment. The problem in general to me, and actually I'd argue that Marxism itself is a form of paternalism, funnily enough. And then this is, again, it's brought up by Thaddeus Russell, I think George Bernard Shaw as well. I might be getting his name wrong. That, you know, socialism in the classical, even the modern sense, is kind of puritanical. For all the talk about socialists, you know, they subsidize free college. They don't subsidize free trips down. Well, they might subsidize free trips down lazy rivers or things like that. Or free gambling trips and things like that. They might actually end up subsidizing that. But even today, you know, the things that people, socialists try to get subsidized or nationalized, like the education system, there's a sort of puritanical character to it, for better or for worse. So this relates back to theology. You know, not to always bring everything back to, you know, what is the good life and so forth. But I think to a certain extent is relevant. I was recently in Nevada. Outside of Las Vegas, in general, in my opinion, casinos are kind of bad places. Vegas tries to make it look like Disneyland. And also, Nevada is one of the places, as well as Western Europe, that has legalized prostitution. To a large extent, I think these are sort of drab, depressing places in general, especially those small towns that have these casinos. The people in there don't look very happy. Although this goes back to the Inception question that was asked in Inception, you know, I think Leonardo DiCaprio, whatever his character is, goes and visits. There's some people who just choose to spend all day connected to a dreaming machine. Why they choose it? And the sort of like shaman type character asks, who are you to judge them for wanting to stay in a dream world all day and not the quote unquote real world? I think that's a relevant question. You know, is the person who's just throwing all the coins into the slot machine, is that person living a good life? It's worth pointing out, most Marxists don't think that. If you ask them, they think that they're just, you know, rebelling against the capitalist hellhole. That's what they might say. I'm skeptical of that. I'm skeptical of that, by the way. You know, if you watch enough dystopian novel or movies or novels like A Brave New World, this seems like what many people's dream world is, for better or for worse, by the way, for better or worse. And of course, today, many people will work for corporations or the heck, this is where modern day China, the CCP China, is to a certain extent, you know, has basically all the bizarre features. I mean, people go work very hard to go buy expensive cars or buy expensive, you know, technology, as well. So again, I think the problem with paternalistic policies is they work in some sense. I mean, I think banning casinos, in a sense, is rational. If you have a conception of the good life that doesn't involve gambling, I think banning the neighborhood poker game is irrational. Although this becomes a continuing problem where the Amish start banning like innocuous games, not the Amish, but some people start banning innocuous games like Pinochle or Rummy Cube, or they're just games and you're just wasting your time playing games. You should be out, you know, working in the field, serving the Lord. That's what you should be doing. And this is where you get an extreme problem. And picking this golden mean about the true path through. And I do agree with your point about free will. There's a certain extent when someone commits a crime, even the people the left doesn't like. Take Dylann Roof. I mean, is I like the, you know, these are the people I like to bring up for socialists. Is Dylann Roof, is his crime because he lived in a capitalist hellhole, or is he innately evil? I like to ask sometimes these questions on comment forums to people, to somewhat troll them, but because some of them I'm genuinely curious. You know, I mean, people make bad decisions, and they get bad outcomes. Do they deserve to experience the outcomes, or should we try to proactively remove things in a paternalist way? I'm not sure. And again, back to the point about benevolent dictators and the sort of bootlegger Baptist coalition. Sometimes you get weird coalitions with paternalistic policies, where the two groups of people that want to ban alcohol are now the rum runners and the gangsters, who say, well, you know, if the neighborhood grocery store can sell alcohol, what's our business? And then of course the Baptists, who say, well, it's because God bans it. It's bad for you. So it becomes these paternalistic policies sometimes get sort of weird coalitions of people who benefit from them. But I agree in theory that, you know, if you could ban certain things, I think they would make good. But this goes again back to teleology and, you know, purpose and what is the good life. Swithin?
My view on the paternalistic policies is twofold. Firstly, one reason why I dislike banning and forcing of things is because going to the casino as an entertainment activity could be perfectly consistent with a good life, as I mentioned previously. I mean, if you treat it well, this is just your entertainment, it would be like going into the theater and you go to the casino instead. I mean, you could make a claim that the theater is somehow intrinsically better, and in some sense you might be able to do that. But as long as you accept the illicitness of games as such, then you could make a reasonable claim for that. So one thing I think, stopping people doing things which are in principle fine, even though they may do it in the wrong proportions, harms people from living as good a life as they could. I think this is one reason why I have broad, sort of a libertarian of a somewhat unorthodox one, was being in school and the class being punished, and I didn't do anything, but I was prevented from doing things that I otherwise would be. I'd go out to break or whatever and go outside because or other people have been disruptive, and so it gets everybody in. It's like, well, why should I have to stay in when everybody else has done bad stuff? So which my position is, well, if you're going to mess stuff up, well, that's not my fault, you mess it up. But if you want to take a more paternalistic approach, as I said before, I think determining when it's a good use of your money and your resources is very difficult. So I think we discussed this to some extent with our original coronavirus episode. Let's suppose we kind of, I think it was related to that. It's like, do we want to sort of like tank the economy now and have it so that more people can survive longer in the more elderly people? I suppose that's slightly different in that that's somebody else measuring with somebody else's sort of the young person and the old who are existing at the same time. But it raises the interesting point is that, well, would you rather have more money when you're young or when you have more money when you're old? Well, it depends. So the forced savings schemes kind of makes sense, but you would, and some of the money would have more benefit now than it would have in the future. So a good example of this would be, my wife's parents said to her, all you should do is pay down the mortgage as much as you can to pay off the mortgage quickly as possible because you'll save money that way, which is true. But whilst that would have been good on its own, it would have been, we decided that actually it was better for us to actually improve the house and not pay it off as quickly so that we had better functionality when the children were small, because the children are 8, 5, 5 and 3. And so it'd better have a big house, and it would be, you know, it would give overall more benefit to spend the money now. So this is the problem, I think, we say, for saving schemes, is whilst they accept that some people would go like that and have absolutely no money whatsoever. I mean, money when you're old, money when you're young isn't the same. I mean, why would you want to have lots of money when you're basically bedridden in your old age, or you can only just walk around the block? Like, should you have lower amounts of money so you can just get your TV subscription and spend all the money when you're younger, when you can actually do things? I mean, that seems to be more rational. So I think you have a huge knowledge issue here. And so whilst it's the case, I think a lot of people will make poor decisions about their own life, I think other people would make worse ones. So in a sense, I have a very pessimistic view of how you can approach this. So that, I think, is a problem. I mean, also with forced savings schemes, you actually have to know what people's income is. And that also presupposes income tax. And income tax is clearly very bad for many different reasons, which we could go into another time. So a lot of these schemes, even though on the surface they think, oh, they make sense, they actually require a huge amount of bureaucracy to put together. Now, with this general opposition to paternalistic policies, I would say that I think you might have a better argument in situations which you could claim that the action on itself is intrinsically immoral, rather than it's only immoral in the wrong proportions. And I think I would make an argument here for sort of active euthanasia prohibition of being a good thing, in the basis that euthanasia, your goal is to seek to end your own life. And since the substance and nature of a thing determines what's good for it, sort of existence in itself is sort of like the most basic good, trying to act in such a way to deliberately terminate it would be objectively bad. Therefore, you could make a defense of prohibiting it on the basis it's bad for somebody. And this would be different, I think, from the other situations, because unless, of course, you were going to say that those things in and of themselves are objectively bad. But again, even if you did, you get the odd continuum problem with games, which goes into an odd way, which I don't think you get with euthanasia. Now, we can debate as to whether euthanasia is a good or a bad thing, but I think you have a better claim when you can say that the action is universally always immoral. Now, you still have empirical problems as to working out whether, in fact, it's active euthanasia or you are seeking not to take, because you, I mean, you could make the claim that not taking medical interventions is euthanasia, although that's a long argument which I don't want to go into now. But I do think if you could make a claim that something is objectively bad, in any good life it wouldn't be there, then you could prohibit it. And I think it would make the case to euthanasia. But I think the other ones have too much of a bureaucratic machinery to try to implement, and you just have an intractable knowledge problem. And also, of course, to get to the benign dictator problem, no skin in the game. And if you've got a central director who's trying to direct lots of people's lives, he doesn't really care if they succeed or they fail. And this is why I think if you're trying to improve, especially the lives, as it were, who have a natural slavish disposition, the only way to help them is to get charities and individuals who actually know people and are involved with them, and so can see their life in a more holistic manner and try to help them on an individual basis. And that's why, as it were, welfare is bad in the welfare state, because all they do is give them money, which doesn't solve any of the root problems. So you just sort of end up subsidizing bad decision making. Whereas what you need to do really is to solve it at the root and sort of change the situation in which they're making the decision. Tim, any thoughts on anything I've just said?
The euthanasia point is interesting, but I think I addressed it with the taboo point about theology and so forth as well. You know, what is the good life and so forth. As far as the comments about the having more money now or more money later, this relates to, again, back to theology and what is the good life. It's interesting your comments on the mortgage. You know, in this regard, the ones who say credit is bad, the Christians in particular, who said, you know, banks and, you know, usury and all this stuff is bad. Well, technically, maybe not. Maybe not. So maybe they actually have a good purpose. Maybe the much maligned Joel Osteen is actually correct. But we won't get into that. But nonetheless, again, as you said, the problem with paternalist polities, as I said before, is there's not that good supply of benevolent dictators, and the bureaucracies have no skin in the game, and the bureaucracies will probably start pursuing their own interests, and they'll just become a sort of parasitical organization. And so forth. I mean, this is the funny the conclusion of some of the historical paternalistic policies, like the public schools, for example. I have very similar experience with public schools as you do here in the United States. I find them as an individual to be very much enslaving. But in some areas, they're just sort of turning into zoos, which, you know, is fine. I mean, Thaddeus Russell and Michel Foucault might be happy about this in some ways. But I mean, they're neither the paternalizing forces, and they're actually not that good of a party anyway. So they don't do really anything very well. And I think prohibition ended that way in the United States as well. And the sort of prohibition broadly, including going after drugs as well, which again, don't tell many people on the left, but many Democrats supported these sort of hard incarceration policies as well. But don't tell, and actually Joe Biden supported them too, but don't tell that Democrats, and I think there's similar history in Britain as well. So the trouble with paternalistic policies is, you know, again, who's going to do the paternalism? There's not, again, a good spot, but with dictators, it ends up being bureaucracy, and you end up with bootlegger Baptist problems. Broadly, I think we're getting closer to the end here. Broadly, I think Aristotle, in a way, ends up being somewhat right. There is a huge definition problem of it, and in this regard, I think the Marxists and your standard socialists and your standard people on the left engage in double dipping. They'll claim that actual existing current capitalism is slavery, yet they'll complain about it. Then they won't own up to that, but they just made a continuing argument where one end of the continuum is their utopian socialism. But if you ask them, you know, George Bernard Shaw and many socialists, and Thaddeus Russell tends to do this, and Michel Foucault did it, Chomsky as well, their utopian forces people to work too. So it seems to believe their utopian ends up having the same characteristics of the current society. So broadly, is Aristotle right? I would say yes and no. That's a somewhat of a cop-out answer, but that's my general disposition toward Aristotle's argument about natural slaves. And one final point, just so I'm it's worth pointing out that I think about a few million white Christians, well, depending on who you think is white, were enslaved by the Ottoman Empire and the North Africans. So as far as, you know, so slavery has existed elsewhere. It's not always in this way that, you know, many people think it exists. You know, the Ottomans enslaved, I mean, the Ottomans were all the way up almost to Vienna. And the Ottomans acted very much like the Romans, and same way with the North Africans, you know, the Barbary coasts and so forth. And actually today, where do you find slave markets? Like, it's in, like, you know, it's in Libya. Hillary Clinton's episode, that's what we ended up with, where their current existing slave markets are. Or slaves exist in, like, of course, as I mentioned, in Russia with North Koreans. So, yeah, slavery exists in places. And I don't think in those areas it's beneficial for the slaves. So maybe it is analyzing contents of an empty box. Swithin, any final comments?
I think you have a definition issue. I think the Marxists want to treat everything that is quote-unquote oppression as the same form of oppression. And I think you can make reasonable distinctions that you can be oppressed but not be a slave, and there's a particular form of it, and there are words that are available to describe the actual existing reality. And yes, certainly, in the world today, anybody who you could consider broadly a slave is not having a good time of it. As I would say, the history of slavery is multifaceted, and there's various different types and different time periods. And that's quite an interesting topic in its own right, although it's treated very badly in most cases. It's just an excuse to get annoyed. And you are right as well. I think I remember reading that I think there were more sort of Europeans enslaved into the Barbary slave trade than West African blacks to the USA. But of course, for various political reasons, that isn't talked about as much. So my final thoughts of Aristotle and the natural slave. I do think, in a broad sense, not a strict sense, the natural slave clearly does exist. But as paternalism doesn't work. I mean, voluntary paternalism, I suppose, in some extent, in social shunning, you could go down that line. But as a legal form, I think largely doesn't work, apart from when things are objectively bad in all circumstances. But again, you can argue whether that's true or not. But if that was the case, and I think there is a category, I think euthanasia would fall into it. And so you do have these sort of natural slavish type people, but on a pragmatic basis, they're better off not being slaves and probably best off being sort of servants, even if they do kind of waste their money, because I think that can be better ameliorated by charity. And obviously, if you didn't have the welfare state indirectly subsidizing poor behavior, then there'd be the natural slave would be make less bad decisions than he otherwise would, just on an obvious economic angle to himself. So yeah, Aristotle, I think, is broadly correct, but it's just not practical to have the benign natural slaveholder. I suppose you would be the natural slaveholder in a sense, because you have the concubine, natural slave and slaveholder, so that makes sense. So thank you, everybody, for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please share it with your friends and family, and please subscribe to us on YouTube. The more subscribers we get, the higher we get in the rankings, and the more people can listen to this. If you have any questions or comments, please contact us at mindcrimelibertyshow@gmail.com. That's mindcrimelibertyshow@gmail.com.